along with Doug Gray and Jake Hamlin, and you are listening to the Project Prospect Podcast, slash first mini media podcast. How's it going this evening, guys?
It's going good, Adam. How are you?
All right, all right. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Doug's work, he's a moderator in our forums, a regular poster. Also, when I think about bloggers online, I typically think of people who sit behind computer screens and don't actually make it out to games. They're copying links and regurgitating information. Doug is an analyst, I'd say, more so, someone who regularly attends games and I believe so is a credentialed media member, right, Doug?
Yeah, that is correct.
There we go. Doug's expertise is the Reds. However, I think, Doug, we're going to torture you tonight and keep the Reds talk to a minimum, just like I don't like let Jake talk about Buster Posey. Is that okay?
That works for me.
So what we wanted to cover tonight, or whatever time of the day you're listening to this, is some of the statistics that we'll be using in the Digital Prospect Guide. I think we're a little abnormal with the measures that we like to use. However, though they are dissimilar from what you'd see on a baseball card, they are things that we spend a lot of time into determining whether or not they're worthy from an analysis perspective. And some of the stuff that you're going to find in a lot of places on the internet that we'll be using will be things like weighted on base percentage, walk percentage, isolated power, fielding independent pitching statistic. There are some that I guess people might call modern metrics. And in addition to that, we are going to be using a lot of ball and play data. And just to kind of give some of you a background on ball and play data, if you're thinking, what does a line drive percentage mean to me? What does a ground ball percentage mean? Can you give us a little intro on why those stats mean something to you, Doug?
Well, you know, line drive percentage, I mean, clearly, you know, line drives are balls that are hit hard and on a straight line. They're much more difficult for a guy, you know, to turn into an out. You know, the more that a guy's actually hitting, the more likely it is for that guy to have more hits and therefore have, you know, higher batting average, higher slugging percentage, higher on-base percentage, just because he's getting on base even more. Guys that hit lots of ground balls, for example, you know, they're probably not going to slug as much because you can't hit a home run on a ground ball, and that's, you know, the biggest component of slugging percentage because it adds, you know, four total bases to that.
How about you, Jake? What does ball and play data mean to you?
You know, again, there are so many sort of confounding variables when you look at what happens, you know, with the stats the players put up. You look at guys who, you know, depending on the ballpark, sometimes a ball's a home run. In one ballpark, it's a home run. In one ballpark, it's an easy fly ball out. And what we feel like is ball and play data helps us sort of sort through a little bit more what a player's actual skill set is. And, you know, like Doug mentioned, you can tell, how good is his power? Well, if he hits the ball on the ground 3 out of 4 times, he probably doesn't have a ton of power. You know, if you see a guy who hits massive line drives, you can see this is a guy who makes good contact. This is a guy who can, you know, get his bat on the ball. And it tells you, you know, it tells you a lot about what a player's actual, you know, actual talents are, which I think is a really valuable tool to have access to.
There is a lot of benefit to statistics that should be relatively independent of the facilities, the parks they're being accumulated in. You'd hope that a ground ball would be a ground ball anywhere on this planet. It's likely that fly balls are going to be similar, line drives. There's going to be technology before long that can give us the degree in which a ball travels off the bat, the angle it's taking, as well as the velocity. And then we'll really be able to get some solid line drive data and ground ball and all that, break it into different hit types. And I think it's important to note that the ball and play data that first inning employees, and I think a lot of sites use, is based on visual observations. There's someone checking a box, was this a line drive? Was this a ground ball? And granted, that is subject to some human error. I'd hope that most baseball professionals would be able to discern between different types of contact, but eventually a lot of those positions are going to be replaced by computers. It should be more accurate. And to me, really, the most valuable aspect of ball and play data is sample size. When you're looking at what a guy does over the course of the season, I don't really want to rely on countable instances if I don't have to, how many singles he had, how many doubles he had. There are a lot of variables in what plays into a single versus a double, what plays into a double versus a home run. if you're just looking at the type of contact, I think you can tell a lot about the player a guy is, and that is something that's starting to be studied that we're involved in studying. If a guy's two deviations above the league average in ground ball percentage throughout his minor league career, what does that say about his power ceiling in the big leagues? And maybe jumping into a little bit, we wanted to do some player comparisons of guys who are going to be in our top 25 prospects list coming up with the digital prospect guide, something we're hoping to have done in the very near future. Buster Posey's a guy who we've talked about a lot this offseason, where we believe his power potential is limited due to the amount of ground balls he's hit in his first full season in the minors. You guys want to roll with me here and compare Santana, Carlos Santana, a little bit to Buster Posey? Maybe starting off with you, Doug. We'll give Jake a shot clock for how much Buster Posey time he can have. How do those two prospects compare to you?
You know, they're two of the best prospects in all of baseball. Easily, you know, the two best catching prospects in my mind. You know, Jesus Montero, just because you don't really know if he's going to be able to stick at catcher. But, you know, those guys are both, they've got a few warts. But offensively, I think that I like Santana a little bit better. You know, he's got excellent plate discipline, just like Buster Posey does. But I think that, you know, his power ceiling is a little bit higher. You know, as you noted, Buster Posey's got the high ground ball rate. I'm not sure that he's going to be able to hit for a lot of power. You know, defensively, you know, the tools are all there, but, you know, he's got a ways to go still. You know, Carlos Santana, you know, former third baseman, now playing catcher, he too has a ways to go defensively, but I just think that his bat is just a little bit better. And defensively, they both have, you know, a similar amount of distance to go before I think that they're, you know, major league average catcher.
I'd argue, too, and I haven't seen Santana play other than video, but I have talked extensively with people who've observed him very closely. And to me, listening to how good Santana's arm is and how he is a good ball blocker, I would argue that he probably has a higher defensive ceiling than Posey, who has a pretty good arm, pretty good footwork. He was a shortstop in high school in his first year in college. But Posey strikes me as a guy who's a pretty good bet to turn into a solid average defensive catcher, whereas I think Santana could be a well above average defensive catcher. Jake, can you give us maybe some of your opinions on why you think Carlos Santana is so special?
Sure. You know, before we talk, you know, a little bit, I want to sort of frame this discussion about defense. And some of you might be wondering, because those of you who follow Project Prospect and First Inning Rankings know that we have Jesus Montero rated very, very highly. And, you know, Doug was a little bit dismissive of him, and it sort of goes to an argument that we've had about how do you classify Jesus Montero, and is he, you know, do you consider him a catcher? Do you consider him a likely DH, because no one seems to think he's going to stick a catcher? But he's definitely in conversation on this same tier of prospects as Posey and Santana, if not above. So when we say, like, clearly the two top catching prospects, we're thinking now more about a combination of offense and defense rather than, like, just overall all told. As far as Santana goes, you know, what's interesting about Santana, and one of the things that we have a really hard time judging, one of the things that stats does not tell you very much about, is how good a receiver a guy is. You know, we talk about he can block balls, he's got a good arm, but there's the sort of the dynamic of the pitcher-catcher relationship, which is, you know, I think a lot of the question marks that people have about both of these guys, you know, getting into the major leagues. So, you know, with that, all that background, that being said, Carlos Santana could be a pretty special bat. You know, a guy, switch hitter with that kind of power behind the plate is, you don't see that very often. And, you know, the Indians have, you know, they had Victor Martinez, and now they've got Santana. They seem to be the only team that can find, you know, power hitting, switch hitting catchers, which is a pretty cool thing. But I think it's going to be really interesting to see how, as his defense continues to develop, how far his bat can carry him, because he could really be a special, special player.
Yeah, and Santana was someone who reached high A before being put back in low A the following season in order to learn how to catch. He's a very, very patient hitter. He has a lot of power, good line drive hitter. But he is still relatively new to catching. In terms of the value of receiving, when you think about a catcher, his primary job is to catch the ball. And if you're a catcher who can't receive, which is basically catching the ball, it's not really a good sign. However, guys can typically improve their receiving skills. When you're looking for a guy who's a good receiver, you're looking for someone who can stick his glove out, catch the ball where it's thrown, and hold it there. You don't want the little league catcher who snags the ball from out of the strike zone and tries to pull it back in. That probably will get a pitcher fewer strikes. You want someone who catches the ball where it's caught, holds it there. There's some people who got excited about, I think it was Mike McBride. Was it Matt McBride? Help me out here, guys. The Indian catcher. Matt McBride, how he's a good contact hitter for a lot of power in the AFL. But if you watch his defense for a little bit, guys run on him right and left. He's not a good receiver. He's such a bad receiver that not only does he not catch the ball where it's thrown and hold it there, but he drops it a lot. And if you're a catcher who's dropping pitches for your pitcher, you're making them look terrible. So I think with Carlos Santana, and these days to be a good catcher, you almost have to have some level of bilingual abilities. And I'm not sure how much English Santana speaks at this point of his career, how comfortable he is communicating in English, but I could understand if you're a pitcher throwing to a guy who you're maybe having a little difficulty communicating with, he's not catching everything and receiving it well, he's not making you look good. You want someone behind the plate who's going to take your mind off thinking about exactly what you're going to throw, who's out there to make you look good. And at this point in his career, even though Santana does have good defensive raw tools, I promised people I wouldn't use the word raw this year. Even though he is someone who has a strong arm, who blocks balls well, I think he's someone who could hone on his receiving skills and learn to call a better game and turn into a potential above-average catcher. Contrasting the two a little bit offensively, Doug, how would you compare their approaches to hitting?
You know, they both seem very patient at the plate. You know, they walk just as much as they strike out, if not more for the most part. You know, Posey slowed down ever so slightly when he went to AAA, but, you know, he's still six less walks than strikeouts. I think Posey, you know, it seems he's more content, you know, hitting line drives everywhere, whereas I think that, you know, Carlos Santana, he does have a little bit more power in the bat. I'm not necessarily sure that he's swinging for more power, but he does seem to result in a little bit more power. He hits the ball harder. You can just kind of watch him and see, and the ball just comes off of his bat a little bit harder than it does with Posey.
I think in watching them, too, as far as the patience goes, it's interesting because they both come in with a different kind of patience. Posey is standing there centered and balanced and without any movement when he's waiting for the ball to come in, and then his pitch comes and he locks in on it and crushes it. Santana's almost up there with a bit of a swagger, wagging his bat in the air. He doesn't have the same kind of, maybe textbook is an okay word to use here, hitting mechanics as Posey does. Posey's someone, or you can tell he's a polished college hitter, that he has a very refined offensive approach, where Santana kind of looks like someone just put him in the game. He's excited to hit. He wants to make the pitcher look bad. But both of them do have a unique ability where they're able to eventually get the pitcher to throw the pitch that they're looking for more often than not. And that's why I see both of them as guys who could be above average big league hitters. It's a lot of fun to watch both of these guys.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting. Posey is very much like, you know, you think of him as a scout's dream, sort of the polished hitter is exactly the way to describe him.
Wait, I thought we weren't going to let you talk about Posey.
You said I had a shot left.
Okay, you got 30 seconds. Go.
30 seconds. I actually was just going to say this one thing about Posey, which is that he is so clearly, you know, if he fits all the check marks that a scout would have. And Santana, you know, like you talked about, when you watch him bat, he's much more excited. He looks a lot more like a little kid. You know, Posey looks like a professional hitter, and Santana looks like a little kid. But they get incredible results, and both approaches, I think, work very well and are well-suited for both guys, which I think is the most telling thing, is that a guy succeed with what he's comfortable with. And if he can do that, he's in really great shape. And I think both guys are definitely working there.
Yeah, they're both good at what they do, and they've both shown success in the upper minors. And I think to an extent there's almost a bias against Santana because he was traded when he was in the minors, and he wasn't traded for an outstanding player, whereas Posey's someone who was a top draft pick. He was followed closely in the draft. He has a prototypical college hitting approach. I think there's a bit of a bias against Santana, and I don't know who put it out there, how it's gotten out there, but when I've really tried to test people on Twitter in our forums, why don't you like Carlos Santana as much as Buster Posey? I haven't been able to get a single good reason. Have you, Doug?
No, and just like you, I've kind of been baffled by it. I mean, you know, you look at the scouting reports, you know, just stats, anything you want to look at with him, you know, he deserves to be, you know, right there with anybody else in the entire minor leagues. And it just seems that for whatever reason, he's kind of been overlooked, you know, almost up until, you know, recently, he's finally started getting, you know, the respect that it seems like, you know, his, you know, scouting report and stats would, you know, dictate that he should be getting.
And there are plenty of talented players who weren't coveted prospects. There aren't that many people who are considered credible prospect rankers. And I think when you get the seal of approval from the credible prospect rankers, you become that much more of a highly touted prospect, be it in a fantasy league, to a group of fans for a specific team, to baseball card collectors. And I think some of the big names in prospecting, for whatever reason, and I'm anxious to hear their logic, haven't given Santana the same kind of seal of approval that they've given Posey. And having seen Posey play about 12 times and talked to a lot of people about Santana and watched some video of him, I really don't understand Posey over Santana. I would much rather have Carlos Santana over Buster Posey, just because I think he has a higher offensive and defensive ceiling. And people might try to make the argument that Santana has a lower floor, but I don't think there's really a good basis to make for that argument, and I haven't heard it yet. Doug, which of the two would you prefer?
I would take Carlos Santana, just for the same reasons you said. You know, I think that the offense is just it's just going to be better in the end. You know, the on-base percentage might be a little bit higher. Batting average might be a little bit lower, but just the power upside, it's just a lot higher for Carlos Santana. And defensively, you know, I'm not quite as comfortable saying that he's got a higher upside as you are over Buster Posey, but at the very least, I think it's a wash. So Santana gets the slight edge in my book.
And Jake, in your most objective, absolute prospect analysis, professional perspective, who do you prefer?
In my most objective, absolute prospect analysis, I do prefer Posey, because I believe he does have a higher floor than.
Why?
A couple of reasons. First of all, I do believe he'll hit for a higher on base percentage in the major leagues. Obviously they both have terrific numbers in the minor leagues. I can only speak from gut feeling, which is at a certain level of what a lot of this is. I think that polish is always a safer bet. And I think that when he comes in as polished as he is.
Why do you think he'll have a higher on base percentage? They both walk about the same amount. I think Santana even has walked more in the upper minors.
It's actually because of the approach that you're talking about, where you have Buster Posey, who is able to, he sits back, he's much sort of calmer at the plate, whereas Santana is moving around more.
Santana walks a lot more. It's actually not even that close. Last year in AA, Santana walked 16.9% of the time, whereas Posey in the California League in High A, he only walked, I believe it was 13% of the time. So Santana's a full deviation ahead of him in walk rate, but you're still going to say you think Posey's going to be the better on-base player?
I still think Posey's going to be the better on-base player.
Why?
Like I'm about to say, I think that it's going to be easier for Posey to adjust to the elite-breaking stuff because of his approach, because he's not moving around so much in the batter's box. I think that will be easier for him. I also think that defensively, all we can do is speak to what we've read, and you know we keep reading in a number of places questions about Santana as a receiver. I think Posey's going to be. I don't think that Posey has the same level of question marks there. And obviously, we're talking about esoteric things, the things that are very much judgment calls. And when you're talking about prospects at this level, at a certain point, it does come down to, you know, to sort of feel. And so that's where it comes down to. I'm sorry, I can't give you a objective statistical analysis that you would like to answer that question. But
for the most part, you prefer Posey because he looks better when he stands in the batter's box. Is that what we're getting at?
Not that he looks better when he's standing at the in the batter's box, but I believe that that sort of more calm approach where he's got less movement in the batter's box when he starts is going to give him an advantage at identifying breaking pitches. He's going to be – it's going to be easier for him, I think, as he advances.
Because he's like a lethal ground ball threat at any time. He can put the ball in a play on the ground any time he wants.
Yeah, and he's – you know, I think it's going to be – it'll be interesting. He's definitely much more of an average hitter. I think that Carlos Santana's power ceiling is much higher. I don't think Posey will ever – I mean, Posey's career year might be 20 home runs, and Santana could average 25 a year, you know.
But you still think that Posey, through his outstanding batting average and receiving skills, which are not polished, could be better than Santana?
Absolutely. If Santana – you know, again, if Santana's floor – Santana's defensive floor, I think, is lower, I think Santana could ultimately
not
get it.
It's not.
If he could not – if he can't learn how to receive at the level that shuts people up, then, you know, that's an issue.
Receive is something that guys can learn pretty quickly.
You're also – I mean, we can – like I said, we can debate this for 4 hours, which I don't think our podcast people necessarily want to listen to, since we've certainly gone more than enough about Posey and Santana. I think that what we really should do, rather than, you know, beating this dead horse, is, you know, I'm clearly in the Posey camp. You're clearly in the Santana camp. Let's see what happens, huh?
Okay. So some other stats that we're featuring in the digital prospect guide. As well as the absolutely ball and play data. We do have home runs per ball hit in the air there for hitters, weighted on base percentage, batting average on ball and play, your typical triple slash lines, batting average on base percentage, slugging, isolated power, and then we did throw a few countables in there, stolen bases and caught stealing, as well as home runs. For pitchers, we've included the number of batters they've hit, their innings pitch total. So we tried to kind of go from some of the traditional stats as well as walks and strikeouts and ball and play data. There are some things that you all are going to see on the back of a baseball card that we're not including, but we're hoping that the statistics can be used to supplement our analysis as well as give any kind of fan with a basic familiarity with baseball sort of a background on where the player stands.
Absolutely. And I wanted to mention a couple of statistics that we're not including in some of the reasons, you know, for some stats that you might expect to see that we're not, that are not going to show up in the digital prospect guide. You know, the sort of bane of many stats people's existence has been the RBI. You won't see minor league RBIs as a stat column in the digital prospect guide. One of the reasons that we've removed RBIs are not there, runs are not there. Basically, we felt like stats that were reliant on a player's teammate, you know, to have some kind of result, either a player had to get on in front of the guy or, you know, he had to get on, his teammate had to knock him in, were not terribly helpful to predict a guy's future performance because he's probably not going to be playing with those same players. There are a whole bunch of sort of context-specific things into the games, and what we're trying to do is create these neutral stats that are really going to show you what a guy's true talent level is rather than, you know, what his potential, you know, what he did in minor league games. We're trying to find the best major league players, not the best minor league players.
I think you see, too, the most popular format of fantasy baseball, for whatever reason, remains rotisserie 5x5. And in that format, RBIs are used, wins are used, runs. Some statistics that you won't find in the digital prospect guide, and we're not doing that because we're trying to hate on rotisserie baseball. We know a lot of people like it, but we believe that a lot of the statistics you can use, the rate statistics, the ball and play statistics, are better indicators of what kind of, if you want to try to guess them, win totals, RBI totals a guy may put up. And I'll echo what you said, Jake, and just that there's a lot of noise. There are a lot of variables in runs batted in and wins and some of those stats. So even though I think they're in a lot of people's comfort zones, they're not something that we feel are all that valuable in terms of prospect analysis. And I'm guessing you're with us there, Doug.
Easily. I really don't have anything else to add. You guys kind of covered everything there.
So maybe we can go on to another player comparison. And how about you start us off here with a couple guys who were recent draft picks. They just finished their first full season, both of them after being drafted in 2008, kind of the head of the class college hitters all along, and both of them faced adversity in their first full season, but I think both of them still have a lot of promise. Who do you prefer between Pedro Alvarez and Justin Smoke, Doug?
I'm going to take Justin Smoke on that one. It comes down to I'm not sure that I trust Alvarez's, you know, strikeout problem. You know, he made some strides this year, but it's still got to be a question for most people.
Yeah, and with Alvarez, people talk about his strikeouts, and I think it's an easy avenue to go down with him just because he walks more than the average player, he hits for more power than the average hitter. Really, his strikeout rate is one of the biggest potential flaws in his offensive game, but when you look at it, in AA Altoona, he only had a 22.9% strikeout rate, so we're not talking Mike Stanton bad strikeout rate. We're talking about a guy who is a very good overall hitter, and that's kind of the one knock on him. And I'll agree with you, Doug, that Smoke doesn't have the same kind of contact concerns, and I think there are a lot of people who will be excited about the power numbers that Alvarez put up. He was able to raise his batting average on balls in play over 100 points between high A and double A. He pretty much split time between those two levels last season. And the line drive percentage, as first inning has it, is a lot higher in double A than high A. Sometimes you might have a home official scorer who's more tentative to give line drives than others, or maybe it just was that when Alvarez got to double A, he started hitting more line drives. But when he hit more line drives, more balls were falling for hits. He was putting up a bit better power numbers, even though they were pretty good in high A too. Whereas a lot of people are going to look at Smoke and go, this isn't a big power hitter. And you can see his World Cup numbers where he hit a home run about every six at bats. And granted, that was international competition, games played in Italy. There's a lot of noise in that kind of data. But Jake, I think you'll agree that there's a pretty, pretty, pretty good chance that Justin Smoke's oblique injury last season played a role in his power struggles.
Absolutely. I mean, anybody who's ever done anything to their oblique can certainly attest to the idea of swinging a baseball bat would probably be pretty painful with something wrong with your oblique. You know, what really draws me to Justin Smoke is the consistency in his walk rate and getting on base, and that even when his power and his calling card has been as a power hitter. When it wasn't there in AAA, he was still walking 14.8% of the time. His on-base percentage was up over 360. You know, I think that bespeaks a guy who was able to, continue to be productive even sort of in the face of adversity, which I think is a good thing. I also feel like when you look at Pedro Alvarez, it's worth noting that we're talking about sort of half seasons at the high A and double A level. There's always, sample size question marks. Whenever someone has a huge jump and you're talking about, 250 plate appearances. So, I think that we'll see a lot about what the real, Pedro Alvarez is at the beginning of next year in terms of where his line drive rate is, and is there some more numbers for that to normalize?
Yeah, and what I've found in my studies, I've done some ball and play, batting average on balls and play research. And yes, line drive percentage has a strong correlation with the type of batting average a player has when he puts the ball in play, i.e. not a strikeout or home run. The other big one is ground balls, which turn into hits a lot more than fly balls. So when you get guys who have very high fly ball percentages, typically their batting average on balls in play are going to be lower than guys who, rather than hitting those fly balls, are hitting line drives or even ground balls. In Alvarez's case, he and Smoke are both well below average runners. Alvarez had 2 stolen bases last year. Smoke had 0. And granted, stolen bases aren't the best measure of speed, but they give you kind of an idea of where a guy is. And in Alvarez's case, he's probably in AAA and in the big leagues going to end up with a batting average on balls in play closer to what he had in high A than what he had in double A. There are no big league hitters who consistently have batting average on ball in play above 400 like Alvarez did last year in AA. And the guys who do go up around 330, the Joe Mauer types, are typically guys who are really good line drive hitters who don't hit a ton of fly balls. So it is likely that you're going to see Alvarez struggle mightily to replicate his AA success in AAA and beyond. But I think another good thing to note here is that Smoke began his pro career in AA, whereas Alvarez finished his first full season in AA, and even with his injury, Smoke went on to play in AAA and was far from an embarrassment at that level. He didn't hit for much power. The only month of the season in which he hit more than two home runs was April, before his injury. But I think it is good to see that World Cup rebound in power, and just watching the two, Smoke has a ton of bat speed, and I think because he's going to make contact a little more regularly than Alvarez, that's going to help his isolated power. The walk rates are kind of a wash, and maybe I can get your opinion on this one too, Doug. I've looked at Alvarez's pictures from when he was in high school, and his junior year he was kind of chubby. Not too bad or anything, not hefty, but a little bit of a big guy, and he trimmed down his senior year, went to Vanderbilt, slimmed down some more, but just looking at pictures of him his junior year and seeing that he has had some weight fluctuations, I'd be pretty surprised if he winds up being a guy who's thin enough, nimble enough to continue playing third base. I really view both of these guys as first basemen long term.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't see Alvarez being able to stick, you know, at third base for more than two or three seasons at the major league level. You know, that's been a concern with scouts for a while now, that, you know, he's going to outgrow that position. It's just a matter of, you know, how long can he stay, you know, I don't want to say skinny enough, but just in good enough shape. You know, I mean, he's still a young guy, and, you know, it looks like, you know, he's only got a few years left. You know, he's going to put on some weight. He's not, you know, a 28-year-old grown man. You know, he's 22, 23 years old. You know, he's going to add some weight. Everybody does at that age, even professional athletes. You know, I just don't see him being able to stick there for more than 3 or 4 years. You know, so long term, yeah, I'm with you. I see them both as first basemen.
And for people who have seen Alvarez, I think it's pretty easy to pick up that he has pretty soft hands and a good arm. So it's hard to imagine him switching to first base. I could see for some people, just because he probably looks good a lot of times at third base. And what I've noticed is in evaluating defense, sometimes it doesn't matter if the guy can play the position adequately. There are so many teams that are in a defensive mindset. You can look at the Red Sox and the type of moves they've made this offseason. And I know there have been some people calculating the amount of runs they'll save based on their defensive upgrades alone. And I think baseball's beyond the point where it used to be that defense was a huge deal, and I think it might have gotten towards the 90s where some guys were putting up such ridiculous offensive numbers that maybe defense got pushed aside a little bit. But now I'd say it's back stronger than ever, and if you have a guy typically who has any kind of defensive doubts, Jake, would you agree that it seems like more often than not he's moved off the position if there are any questions about him?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that ideally in Pittsburgh's case, they're hoping that Andy LaRoche shows up and that they don't have to, it becomes easy to move him across the diamond. But, you know, that's another piece of sort of the prospect analysis game, is you got to look at not just how a guy is built at age 18, but, you know, what's his build going to lead to as time goes by. Defense, as we're discovering now that the, you know, steroids are not as prevalent, the numbers have come down to slightly more realistic levels. Guys aren't going to be able to put up, you know, OPSs of 1,800 like Barry Bonds did, so it didn't matter that he was basically, you know, he could have sat in his Barcalanta in left field and played a more effective defense. Nowadays, you really need to be a more complete package. So I think that guys like Alvarez, who, you know, maybe in 1997 a team would have said, screw it, we'll put him at third and see what he can do, are now more likely to move him to first base and see if they can find a guy who can really be a glove there.
And just because we haven't touched on it yet, in watching both of these guys, the only time I've gotten a chance to see him, I went out of my way to see Smoke at minor league spring training, but he was up at big league camp at the time I went to Rangers camp. And seeing both of them play on TV against Cuba in the World Cup, both of them struggle very much with breaking balls. They're guys who get down on their front foot early in their hitting approach, and that's kind of where they leverage in and get their power. As Steve Carter, our swing analysis, will point out in the blurbs that you'll see in the digital prospect guide, front foot hitters like Smoke and Alvarez are guys who tend to have to commit to swinging to the pitch earlier than a guy who might be more centered over his back leg or even be back on his back leg. I think the ultimate example of someone who's giving himself the maximum amount of time to see a pitch is the Little League hitter who's leaned so far back. I almost think of Eddie Goodell when he's taking pitches, that he's not really – he's completely ready to hit whatever comes up because he's given himself the maximum amount of time to see it. Whereas with Smoke and Alvarez, with their power approaches, they're stepping into the ball. They're trying to get everything they can into it, which makes it a little difficult for them to hit breaking balls compared to some other guys. And watching Smoke, I saw him fall out of a rhythm where he was so fooled on breaking balls and pretty much just looking for a fastball that he could hit out of the park that by the time he had taken enough breaking balls for strikes or done half swings through him, when he got thrown a fastball, he wasn't ready for it. And Alvarez may be a slightly better breaking ball hitter of the two right now, but it's both something that, for that reason, I could see they get both of them spending a little more time in the minors next season just to hone that ability. And I think they'll come around, but that's probably the reason why I wouldn't expect either of them to make a team out of spring training. And if they do, I wouldn't expect them to be successful in the big leagues next year, at least as far as being above average hitters. Jake, do you have any absolute response to that?
Any absolute response to that? That absolutely sounds about right. You know, with, you know, both guys have huge question marks, Alvarez with the strikeouts and Smoke with the power that I think both of their teams are going to want them to prove. You can always assume that teams are conscious of the arbitration clock, and so has got, you know, so many top prospects are like, who, even if they're ready, are likely to start in AAA for the first couple of months anyway. So these are two guys who you want to watch and see if they're going to get out of the gate quickly. If they do, they could be really interesting midseason fantasy pickups. You know, they could be really guys who impact the second half of the year. So, you know, it'll be fun to watch.
And Jake, who would you take between Smoke and Alvarez right now?
I would take Justin Smoke right now.
How about you, Doug?
Justin Smoke.
And I'll confess, and this is kind of a sneak preview of the Digital Prospect Guide, I almost made Jake's head explode last night when we pretty much had the top 10 formatted and polished, and I told him we had Pedro Alvarez there right at the end of it, and Justin Smoke wasn't. And after watching video of both of them and analyzing him, I said, Jake, we got to put Smoke in the top 10 instead of Alvarez. They're both very good hitters, but I can't see putting Alvarez ahead of Smoke right now. And I think it was part of just realizing how much Smoke's injury did impact him. And I think he's someone who's going to hit the ground running next year. And both of these guys are guys who could surface as above average big league hitters. And I don't believe in Smoke's glove as much as some people have reported. I think he's probably an average defender at first base. Maybe that's what Alvarez ends up being too, but I think Smoke's the more polished all-around bat, so if you figure their defense is close to a wash, I'm going to go with Justin Smoke, too. I want to throw out just a few averages, and maybe you guys can chime in here, too. For people who haven't looked at walk percentage, strikeout percentage, some of the in-play data, just to give you a kind of baseline to work off of, I think it's easier to adapt to stats once you're more familiar with them. For the most part, with a minor league hitter, what I found in 2008 was the average walk rate was right around a little under 9%. In some leagues like the PCL, where guys can hit the ball out of the park with regularity, it was a little bit over that. Whereas you'll find in the lower minors, guys aren't quite as patient. More pitchers just offer up fastballs and hitters are swinging at them. They're looking to prove themselves by driving the ball, not by taking walks. So in the lower minors, the walk rate's usually a little bit lower. I think it gets a bit higher in the big leagues, too. Kind of the reverse trend in the minors, where the strikeout percentage is higher in the low minors than it is the high minors. And then it goes down even more in the big leagues. It's funny when you think of Alvarez and his 22% strikeout rate. That's actually about a deviation above the big league average, even though it's not close, or it's maybe closer to half a deviation above the minor league average. So the minor league average strikeout rate is going to be around 19%. And to me, what's nice about walk and strikeout rates is you can think about them from a hitter and a pitcher's perspective. And keeping those averages in mind, those aren't just for hitters. It's baseball's a game where the pitchers are the reciprocal of that. Doug, how do you typically incorporate walk percentage and strikeout percentage in your analysis?
Well, you know, with pitchers, you know, the walk percentage, depending on the player's age, it doesn't really jump into my, you know, analysis too much, unless it's, you know, a full, you know, standard and a half deviation, you know, ahead of things. I think that, you know, as a pitcher gets older, they're going to harness their control a little bit better. You know, they're going to have more polish on all their pitches. So I think that it really depends on, you know, the age of the player and the level that they're playing at. You know, if you've got a 19-year-old guy that's playing in double A, you know, you don't really expect him to, you know, be league average. So it really just depends on, you know, the specific player that we're talking about.
I found in my studies that walk percentage in comparison to strikeout percentage is relatively stable, that for the most part, people like to talk about a guy can improve his walk percentage as he goes up through the minors. That rarely, rarely, rarely happens. For the most part, a guy's going to be pretty similar within a deviation or so of kind of the base rate that he puts up if you look at an extended sample. I find in college in particular, there are examples of guys who are such imposing hitters that they start getting pitched around. So I think you can see guys who, maybe Vladimir Guerrero is a good example. He's not a remotely patient hitter. However, his walk rate has gone up to a respectable level over his career because I think he's gotten to the point where he gets pitched around, even though he's an older player now, a good amount. Whereas strikeout percentages, both on the hitter side and the pitcher side, you can see a lot more variation. You can take a guy from low A who's maybe a half deviation above the strikeout rate average, and then by the time he reaches AAA a few years later when he's matured, he might be a half deviation below it. So when I see guys who have really low walk rates, I think it indicates a low ceiling in that they're going to make a lot of outs, because rather than walking about the average of the league, they're going to be subject to the 30% of the balls you hit in play typically turn into hits. Whereas the guys who have really low strikeout rates, I think it's typically a good sign because they can continue to improve it as far as hitters go. And you will see pitchers that when they jump up a level, maybe their stuff doesn't quite work for that level. And you can see a drastic decline in strikeout rate. That's one thing we saw with Madison Bumgarner last year. He went from a guy who was a well above average strikeout pitcher in low A to more of an average pitcher in terms of strikeouts in high A and double A. And then thinking about strikeouts, just wrapping this one up, you're thinking I wanted to discuss a little bit more. Desmond Jennings and Dustin Ackley are two other guys who are going to be in our top 10 prospect list, guys who we've gotten to see. Doug, how would you compare those two hitting approaches?
You know, both guys are, you know, top of the line hitters. I don't think that either one of the guys is going to have a lot of power, although I was intrigued by your comments in the forums earlier about, you know, some of the batting practice displays that, you know, Dustin Ackley put on. I wasn't out there to see that with you guys, so I'm not really – I don't have any firsthand experience of seeing that.
And you're talking about the Fall League, right?
Yes, but your comment did intrigue me with, you know, that he had some of the more impressive, you know, power displays in batting practice. So, you know, maybe I need to look into that a little bit more. But they seem like very similar hitters, you know, guys that have, you know, they got the combination of good plate discipline, you know, good pop, but not really, you know, elite type power. You know, they're both pretty speedy guys. I guess the main difference I see is the positioning. You know, Desmond Jennings, you know, center fielder, you know, and he can play, you know, very good defense right now, whereas Ackley's kind of in transition and we're not really sure what to make of his defense.
Yeah, and Ackley, like you said, with the defense, he could end up in left field. He could play some center field and maybe be average there. And the Mariners have said they want to give him a shot at second base. I don't think there's a good chance he ends up at second base. So I'd still agree with you and say that Jennings probably is going to have more defensive value. Ackley's not known for having a strong arm either. But one thing with Ackley, in talking to him at the Arizona Fall League, and anyone who pre-orders the Digital Prospect Guide gets a bullpen session video that I got from basically right over Steven Strasburg's catcher's shoulder, as well as a Dustin Ackley interview. And in that interview, I discussed with Ackley the reputation that Ichiro had, especially when baseball was promoting the World Baseball Classic and doing all sorts of players from all sorts of countries in the Home Run Derby. And when Ichiro was invited in the Home Run Derby, I think there were a lot of people kind of scratching their heads, but people who had seen him take batting practice regularly said, no, this guy could be a power hitter if he wants to, but he'd rather be a contact hitter. And in talking to Ackley, he admitted he's not a home run hitter, and this isn't the Ken Griffey Jr. I'm not a power hitter and not a home run hitter. This is Dustin Ackley doesn't try to swing for the fences, nor is the swing plane he takes really conducive to hitting the ball out of the park. It's conducive to line drives. And Ackley told me that if being a more of a line drive hitter than a home run hitter is the worst thing that people have against him, he'll definitely take that. So with that in mind, which one of these two do you prefer, Jake?
You know, it's fun. I think this is when you talk about Jennings versus Ackley, I think it's very much one of those sort of ceiling versus floor debates. Jennings is a premium athlete. You know, he's got all kinds of crazy upside just because of the physical tools that he has. Ackley is obviously a very high floor guy. We already know he's going to hit line drives like crazy. He's going to have good patience to be an on-base machine. You know, the question is going to be, what's he going to play on defense? I think that, you know, worst case scenario with Dustin Ackley, you're talking about a guy who's going to be, you know, solid to above average in left field and getting on base at, you know, a high 300, maybe even 400 on base percentage as possible clip. That's a pretty valuable thing. Desmond Jennings, though, is, you know, he's got some game changing potential, especially on defense and center field. I think that the more that we're learning about the value of defense in, you know, to have a guy who can really cover center field, play terrific defense out there, and be a plus with the bat is a very rare thing. So I'll take my shot at Desmond Jennings.
Now, guys, the Fall League had a pretty small sample of plate appearances overall, less than 100 for most of them. I generally like to see 200 plate appearances or total batters faced before I put too much weight into a sample. But to me, it was interesting seeing that Ackley, one of the greatest hitters in college history, and he really put on a show in the College World Series this year, albeit with an aluminum bat, it pretty much seemed like he could hit a line drive wherever he wanted, whenever he wanted. It's fun to see someone in that kind of groove, and I think we're going to see Ackley in that kind of groove regularly. But what surprised me at the Fall League is he really wasn't a good contact hitter. I think he was in the league's bottom 10 in terms of strikeout percentage. He was right around a 22% clip. And as we discussed, 19 being about average for the minor leagues. Even though he was an above average contact hitter in college, his Arizona Fall League performance at least leads me to question a little bit how good of a professional contact hitter he's actually going to be. I still think he'll be average or better, but Jake, just in response to how you were saying Jennings is kind of one of these athletic toolsy guys, who knows how good he could be, I would argue that Jennings has a higher floor than Ackley just because he's already had success in AAA and AA. Perhaps if you're looking at him in 2007 where people said he's a great athlete, he didn't put up a great power numbers, then you could say, yeah, this guy has athleticism, but how well is it going to translate to baseball skill? Having seen what he did in AA Montgomery and AAA, where he caught fire and pretty much made a seamless transition, I would say that Jennings has a much higher floor than Ackley, especially when you factor in the defense. How about you, Doug? What's your take on these two?
You know, one thing I wanted to, you know, bring up as far as Ackley goes in the strikeouts in the Fall League, you know, he set out for a long time without seeing any legitimate live pitching between the college season and the AFL. You know, maybe that kind of played into things too, as far as his contact rate goes. But, you know, just between the two, I'm with you, Adam. You know, Desmond Jennings' floor is it's just ridiculously high, you know, after what he did this year in AA and AAA. You know, I'm not really sure I can find a weakness in his game at all, and he's, you know, been through the highest level of the minor leagues. You know, he's got the plus defense, the plate discipline's there, you know, power, especially for his position, it's there, everything. So, you know, Dustin Ackley, you know, really high draft pick, lots of tools, lots of potential, but he doesn't really have any pro experience to go on, so I can't really see, you know, saying his floor is higher than someone like Jennings who's, you know, coming off a season where he just destroyed the upper minor leagues.
And for those of you who ordered the digital prospect guide, you're going to see a video clip in there of Desmond Jennings where he fouls off about 7 pitches in a row. Just one of those at-bats. It almost reminded me of a Todd Helton at-bat where the pitcher's saying, here's my best offering, hit it. And Jennings says, no, I'm going to foul it off and wait for you to throw me my pitch. And the pitcher keeps repeating the process. And finally, the pitcher comes into his kitchen, and Jennings takes him deep. The one question about Jennings that I found really is just that he didn't have a healthy 2008 at all. He had back injury, shoulder injury. In 2007, he wrapped it up by having knee surgery. So there kind of are some injury questions with him, and you don't really like to have those with someone who's going to be an up-the-middle defender just because of the amount of athleticism and health that's required to play those positions well. But other than that, if Jennings can come out in 2010 and prove that he can play another full healthy season, we're looking at a guy who maybe isn't quite Andrew McCutchen good in terms of center fielders, but it is right up there with him in that he's a patient hitter who doesn't strike out much and has a lot of power potential. I think Jennings is a better contact hitter than Andrew McCutchen. Similar walk rates, not quite as much power, but I think there's a very good chance that Jennings could end up having more value than any minor leaguer who's currently prospect eligible. So I would go with Jennings as well. Any closing comments for you, Jake? Go for it.
Well, I do want to jump in and say, actually, I'm glad you mentioned the injuries, that the injuries are the reason that his floor is lower than Dustin Ackley's. As someone who, myself, has dealt with back injuries, you know, you get a back injury and it can be pretty, you know, pretty athleticism sapping.
Didn't you say you had oblique injuries too?
No, I know people who had oblique injuries. I've never had an oblique injury. I have had back injuries. And, you know, the thing about back injuries is that they don't really heal. They get better, they stop hurting, but back injuries are things that can stick with you for an entire career. And so that is probably the biggest risk with Desmond Jennings right now is that back healthy, how healthy can he stay, and, you know, is it going to hurt his athleticism? Because he's got, you know, the sky really is the limit with him.
And it is promising that he had 10 triples last year, 52 stolen bases. I haven't heard anything about Jennings having any sort of reoccurrence of the back injury that slowed him a bit in 2008. And if we want to talk about back injuries, it was reported as a hamstring injury, and I know we're wrapping this podcast up, but Jason Hayward, who I think a lot of people are going to have as the number one prospect in baseball, was ultimately, doctors determined that he was deemed unfit to continue to play in the fall league because of a back injury.
Interesting. Yeah, that's not a good sign for Jason Hayward at that age.
Closing comments from you, Doug.
I don't think I've got any.
That works for me. I appreciate you joining us on such short notice for your first Project Prospect podcast, Doug. Doug's someone who's helping us out a lot with the digital prospect guide. He runs a website, redsminorleagues.com, where he's pretty much the authority, as far as I've seen, or one of the top authorities in Reds minor league baseball players. So if you want to know anything about any of the Reds, stop by Doug's website, come by our forums. You're going to run into him pretty often. And Jake, I'm anxious to wrap up this digital prospect guide top 10 sample. We'll get out to the bloggers and then carry on with the 25, 100, and 300.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to it. It's going to be fun.
It's going to be an absolutely awesome time, and I'm absolutely excited that all of you downloaded this podcast. We will be talking to you shortly.